Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, January 28, 2019. Street protests continue in various Sudanese towns for 6 weeks.
There was big demonstration on Thursday. Yesterday, they were sitting in over 15 public yards in Khartoum State, along with other cities in Sudan.
And civilians in Kajukeji accuse SPLM-IO commanders of trading in illegal timber.
There are some people trading in these trees. As a community, we don't benefit anything in return from the forest logging. We expected that these trees will one day address the community outcry for clean drinking water.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir downplayed weeks of massive demonstrations during a trip to Egypt over the weekend. He called the protesters, quote, Arab Spring imitators. Back home, protests took to the streets again, marking the sixth week of demonstrations in Sudan. Speaking from London, Dr. Amjad Farid, an external secretary of the Sudan Doctors Syndicate, says the government continues to use excessive force in its response to the protesters.
There was big demonstration on Thursday and on Saturday as well. Yesterday, they were sitting in over 15 public yards in Khartoum State, along with other cities in Sudan. And yes, there was also another wave of detention of peaceful protesters. And as I said, the force is dealt with the protesters with excessive brutality, hitting people in the streets and by arms and also detaining many of them.
You know, I'm in contact with a few reporters on the ground, and some of them are laying low, afraid of doing interviews because they don't want to increase their visibility and, in their view, also increase the risk of them being found by security. What does that say about the nature of the demonstrations?
There was a particular attack on journalists, and many reporters have their license revoked by the National Intelligence and Security Services. And as I said, the government only responds to these protests and public demands is to use violence and excessive violence and detention for everyone who is in Sudan.
What's been the experience of Sudanese doctors on the ground?
The Sudanese doctors have organized themselves in many field teams to help the protesters in the street, especially after it became obvious that the government is using fire bullets against the protesters. However, over tens of doctors have been arrested, including the head of the doctor syndicate, Dr. Ahmed al-Sheikh, and his deputy, Najib Majmedin, who were arrested by the security forces and kept in detention in unknown places, who were arrested in the 25th of December, and also Dr. Mohammed Nagil Assam, who is the spokesperson of the Sudan Professional Association, and also one doctor have been shot dead while he was trying to protect some of the injured and wounded protesters and helping them. Dr. Babikir have been shot dead by the security forces, and many other doctors were also shot by live bullets while they were in the field trying to help the patient.
Now, we saw protests break out in Sudan over the weekend, but we also saw protests in Western cities. There was one in San Francisco, California, in Western United States. And there's also protests in London, where you're at.
Yes. I think the Sudanese in diaspora are providing, are helping to make the sound and the voices of the Sudanese people inside Sudan here. There were protests in Brussels, in London, in Paris, in DC and different and other American states. The Sudanese people are all united now in rejecting this government and saying that it is time to go. say, 3 decades of corruption and political favoritism and mismanagement is enough.
That was Dr. Amjad Farid, the external secretary of the Sudan Doctors Syndicate, speaking to Ayen Dengbior from London. As protests against the Sudanese president Omar al-Bashir continue, the embattled leader has made visits to Qatar and Egypt in what analysts say is an effort to get diplomatic support to strengthen his government. For VOA News, Mohammed Yusuf has this report from Nairobi.
Speaking Sunday in Cairo, President Omar al-Bashir said protesters in Sudan are trying to copy the Arab uprising in 2011 that toppled some leaders in the Middle East. Bashir was visiting Egypt for the second time since the crisis began more than a month ago. Ahmed Suleiman is a researcher with Chatham House. He says Bashir is looking for support in case he starts to lose his grip on power.
Sudan has been reaching out to Russia at the same time to balance those relationships with the West in case they are deteriorating at any stage. So President Bashir has always been very pragmatic in his foreign relations, and he continues to do so in terms of trying to maintain a broad base of support for his government at this time in case he loses support from one side.
The protests in Sudan began in December with demonstrators demanding government reduce the price of fuel and other essential commodities. Sudan's economy has been struggling and foreign currency has been hard to come by since 2011 when South Sudan broke away and took most of the oil reserves. Human rights organizations have accused Bashir's security forces of killing and injuring protesters. Amnesty International says at least 40 people have been killed since the protests began. Government figures put the death toll at 29. Amnesty International Sudan researcher Ahmed Al-Zubair says the situation will get worse if no political solution is found.
You can imagine the scale and the magnitude of the human rights violations at the moment in Sudan. Our expectation this will continue because of the government of Sudan. They are not willing to give any concession to the protesters or provide any kind of political roadmap or to resolve this conflict at the moment.
Sudanese media report the protests are spreading despite mass arrests and a harsh crackdown by security forces. Bashir has accused the opposition and armed groups of trying to destabilize his country and the region. Suleiman of Chatham House says Sudan is headed toward a major political showdown.
You can look at different examples elsewhere, very close in the region in Ethiopia, to see that these kinds of events can take a long time to unfold. But what is clear is that at the moment the protesters are very strong in their demands and the government is also very strong in maintaining its own position and saying that it's not going anywhere.
Bashir has ruled Sudan since 1989, making him the fifth longest serving ruler in all of Africa. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move to Yaounde, where authorities in Cameroon say police shot and wounded 7 people and arrested 117 others over the weekend in several towns where protests occur over what organizers call an electoral holdup. The demonstrations were led by Maurice Kamto, the man who claims he won the October 7th presidential poll in Cameroon. Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaounde.
Sixty people, a majority of them youths, shout as they march through the streets of Cameroon political capital Yaounde, banging spoons and dishes and calling for the unconditional release of everyone arrested during Saturday's demonstrations. Cameroon's Minister of Communication and Government spokesperson René Emmanuel Sadi says the economic capital Douala, the capital Yaounde, and the western town of Bouda were the scene of protests organized by Maurice Kamto and his Cameroon Renaissance Movement Party.
The CRM intended, as usual, to push our compatriots at home and abroad to defy the Republican order with slogans of rebellion and insurgency against legal and legitimate institutions. The government strongly condemns these unacceptable maneuvers to destabilize Cameroon under the false pretext of an alleged electoral holdup.
Incumbent President Paul Biya was declared the winner of the October 7 presidential election by Cameroon's Constitutional Council after the results giving him a landslide victory were challenged by Kamto. Kamto then announced what he called a national resistance program until Biya steps down. The first protests organized by the CRM in late October were put down by police, and the party said 42 people, including some of its officials, had been arrested and detained. They were later freed. Michel Ndoki, a lawyer who defended Kamto at the Constitutional Council, where they alleged massive fraud and ballot stuffing in favor of Biya's ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, CPDM, was one of those arrested during the October 27 and 28 protests. In this Saturday's demonstration, Ndoki was shot in the leg, one of seven wounded, including Celestine Jamin, another CRM official. Ndoki says police used live bullets against the protesters. Cameroon Minister of Territorial Administration Paul Atanganji says riot police did their jobs professionally after they were provoked by the demonstrators. He says Kamto defied a ban on the protest because he wants to destabilize Cameroon.
The forces of law and order did not use any firearms to maintain peace and order. Any contrary information is fake news. The CRM political party and their leaders should not take the leniency of the government as a sign of weakness. As from now henceforth, they will test the bitterness of our laws, which will be applied scrupulously.
Atanganji said similar protests took place in Cameroon embassies abroad. In a telephone interview with VOA, Sylvester Onana, spokesperson for the Cameroon Embassy in Paris, says they had to call in the police after the protest went violent.
Les dégâts, comme vous pouvez vous l'imaginer, sont importants au niveau du rôle de l'ambassade.
He says they are still evaluating the damage, but everything in the embassy was completely ransacked by a group of about 100 Cameroonians singing anti-Cameroon government slogans. He says the French police had to intervene to stop the youth from further destruction. Maurice Kamto says he will continue with the demonstrations against what he says is election fraud, as well as against the government's failure to resolve the separatist crisis in the northwest and southwest regions of the country until Biya leaves office and a solution is found. Biya has been in power for 36 years and is now the second oldest president in sub-Saharan Africa after his neighbor, Teodoro Obiangema of Equatorial Guinea. When his new term is finished, he will be 93 years old. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudanese discuss how to move forward on implementing the revitalized peace deal. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you good at organizing your daily activities?
I can't say that I'm very good at organizing my daily schedule because at some point I could have an emergency thing which would lead me to, you know, not to follow my daily schedule.
There's no way you can wake up and just go anyhow. You have to organize. I'm going to do this at this time and this at that time. So, of course, I organize myself. Most of the time, it's not easy.
Yes, I do. Because, like today, I went to church. Because I know that I'm going to church by 8. Then from church, that's when I relax. I have nothing to do again.
Of course I can, because personally, I have a diary. So I get to note down everything that I'm going to do, like, throughout the day or throughout the week. So each day, I'm always alert.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Participants at a symposium held over the weekend in Juba say the September peace deal faces several challenges, including lack of transparency in the way the government uses revenue. A senior policy analyst in Juba says donors and citizens are concerned that even though the government has increased oil production, the profits are not being used to improve economic conditions across the country. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
Hundreds of youth attended the symposium organized by the SPLM Party Youth League. Participant Zakaria Mbakwech says the deal ignores the participation of youth in several processes, and the warring parties should have involved youth from various political parties during the negotiations.
So the agreement has allocated all the presentation, but it did not specify the youth presentation. Another challenge is that youth actually are the one who become victim of this war, and if it happened to be a time of peace, youth are to actually need to be consulted, really.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwe said at the symposium, the main challenge for implementing the deal is lack of funds, but the government will do all it can to implement the agreement, whether or not donors provide funds. Abraham Awolish, a senior policy analyst at the Sud Institute, says he understands implementation requires some money to train soldiers, but he points out that other important activities require only making decisions like ordering soldiers to stop fighting. Awolish says rather than complaining about lack of funds, the Kiir administration should use its own resources to implement the deal and be transparent about where the government's oil money is going.
The argument of many donors is that they don't know where the government takes the money coming from oil, because salaries are not paid and other critical functions of the government are not paid. Where does the money go? The same question is also being raised by citizens, that the production of oil is going up, the prices of oil are going up, but the economic condition doesn't improve. Where is the money?
Makwe says another challenge facing implementation of the deal is that opposition leaders have not provided accurate troop numbers which would allow the government to budget for security arrangements.
The government is right. It is not funding us because we have not yet presented the budget.
The government says it has deposited $1 million and 100 million South Sudanese pounds for implementing the peace deal into a seed account. Makwe says the money will cover the costs of accommodating members of the National Pre-Transitional Committee whenever they meet in Juba or outside the country. He says he doesn't understand what all the fuss is over transparency.
We have been saying the government of South Sudan has deposited 100 million pounds into the chest of the MPTC. And this is the amount being used now for the accommodation of the staff. None of the donors, none of those who are demanding transparency has deposited anything up to now. None of them has asked us to report to them, because we don't report to them. So this idea of transparency must be a disease of the mind.
Several observers have said the Kiir administration has provided far too little money and should do better. James Akuk, a senior policy analyst at the Center for Strategic and Policy Studies in Juba, says the main challenge to implementing the deal is that the institutions that have been created to implement the agreement during the 8-month pre-transitional period have made very little progress during the nearly 5 months since the deal was signed. Okuk offers a solution.
It's to go back to the drawing board, bring together all the leaders of the main parties, that is the Tigono, SPLM-IO, the SOA, SFDs, and you have the OPP. The leaders must be brought together so that they build a very quick consensus on what is the way forward to get out from this situation where things are stuck. And if they build a consensus on that, they can follow the procedures of amendment within chapter 8 of the agreement, and that one can adjust some of the timelines.
And Okuk says the leaders of the government and opposition can then adjust some of the timelines to suit their needs. The transitional government is supposed to begin in May after the pre-transitional government finishes its work in April, according to the agreement signed by the warring parties last September. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
Some residents in SPLA-IO-controlled areas of Kajukeji County in Yei River State accuse rebel commanders of engaging in illegal cutting of trees from forest and selling them. A rebel spokesman denies the allegation. Daniel Martin Friday visited Kajukeji recently and reports for VOA from Yei.
An identified man cuts down a tree in Kajukeji County, located in a virgin natural forest. Speaking in her native Kukuo language, a local resident who prefers to bed and fight only as Juan for fear of reprisals from the SPLA-IO says that several businessmen are crossing from Uganda into Kajukeji to cut down trees with permission from the SPLA-IO commanders.
There are some people trading in these trees. As a community, we don't benefit anything in return from the forest logging. We expected that these trees will one day address the community outcry for clean drinking water. Women are suffering because we are fetching drinking water from running rivers. We would see trucks loaded with big logs coming from Luolo and Kamapo area under the control of SPLA-IO and are heading direct to Uganda.
Speaking in Kuku, another resident who prefers to bed and fight as Juru for security reasons says while rural women like her are suffering and without access to social services, rebel commanders are busy exploiting the area's natural resources for personal gain.
This war has benefited the senior SPLA-IO commanders. These trees are finishing and we as women, we don't have healthy centers in the village. Lactating mothers and children are dying because there are no health services. We hope that our trees would be used for the benefit of the community. But some SPLA officials are coordinating with some business person from Uganda to loot our resources, and I am not happy at all.
Resident Mule James is appealing to both the SPLA-IO and the Kira administration to stop the illegal cutting of trees. Speaking in Arabic, James calls for an end to the illegal logging, which he says destroys the environment.
There is ongoing rampant forest destruction in this place, and we don't feel good seeing our resources being wasted without tangible benefit for the community. We don't know what will be the impact to our society in the long run, and the government should look into this issue seriously.
Lampol Gabriel, the SPLA-IO deputy military spokesman, denies rebel commanders are involved in cutting down trees.
People who are in Kajukeji, especially in IO control area, they know exactly what is happening with the logging. It is not the SPLA-IO doing the logging. It is the community leaders. They have the landlords. They have the chiefs. So when they saying that the logs are being done by the SPLA-IO senior commander, these are just people who are entities. They also always want to make sure they find a loophole and they find a way, you know, to blame the SPLA-IO. The logging is taking place, yes. But who are those doing the logging? The community are the ones doing the logging.
South Sudan in Focus could not reach a community leader in Kajukeji County to respond to Gabriel's allegations. Stephen Ladu is an economic affairs advisor to Yei River State Governor Emmanuel Adil Anthony. Ladu says over 40 trucks mounted with pulley systems and saw machines are illegally cutting down trees in the area.
This economic value is being shipped in an illegal way through Mijale to Uganda. So this is very dangerous economically, has already affected our per capita and also national government has lost value in that. And the individuals that are cutting, they are now enriching their families in Uganda. And none of the South Sudanese benefited from this. This is a public resources, and this needs to be controlled so that we are able to finance building of schools, we finance building of hospitals, and even finance the counties that are now established in Yei River State.
Evans Sokiri Kijore, the Yei River State Agriculture Minister who visited Kajukeji County last week, says Governor Emmanuel Adil Anthony issued an order banning illegal forest logging.
In Kajukeji, the governor has already issued an order to stop the logging. This is for general the greater Kajukeji. Unfortunately, as a government, we don't have an authority along the territory which is controlled by the IO. But with the peace agreement, we expect that the IO will respect the interests of the people and did not continue to encourage the logging. We expect to communicate to them about the dangers of logging.
A documentary published on YouTube by Kenyan investigative journalist John Alan Namu that exposes corruption by top South Sudanese officials and former officials entitled The Profiteers shows how South Sudanese opposition leaders and others have benefited from the South Sudan civil war, including by exploiting the country's natural resources. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei.
Malawi is the latest African country to look at legalizing cannabis, the plant that produces hemp and marijuana, after similar moves in Lesotho, South Africa, and Zimbabwe. As Malawi's tobacco industry, the country's biggest foreign exchange earner, has dwindled due to anti-tobacco campaigns, farmers are now looking at growing cannabis. Lamek Masina has the story for VOA from Lilongwe.
Malawi has long relied on tobacco, which accounts for 13% of its gross domestic product and 60% of its foreign exchange earnings. But as tobacco prices per kilogram have fallen, farmers like Phineas Chimombo have struggled. He says in most cases, farmers like him, who are already poor, struggle to find money to transport tobacco to the market and sell tobacco as low as 50 cents per kilogram. Health campaigners have eaten into tobacco profits, so farmers like Chimombo are looking to cannabis, the plant that produces marijuana and hemp. He says once one grows hemp, just a small portion of it fetches more money than one can get from any crops a farmer can grow. Malawi is joining African nations, Lesotho, South Africa, and Zimbabwe in looking into legalizing cannabis after years of debate. In March, legislators will consider a bill on legalizing medical marijuana and hemp products. Malawi Parliament member Boniface Kadzamira has long pushed for the legalization of cannabis.
We are the first in this part of Africa to start discussing this thing. Those countries who came after us have gone ahead of us. They have already started issuing licenses.
Malawi's anti-drug campaigners, while legalizing medical marijuana, will encourage more recreational use. Nelson Zakeyu is the executive director of Drug Fight Malawi.
And because local marijuana is commonly cultivated, commonly used in the country, then this one is legalized. It's like they are telling young people to use the local marijuana. So that's what we are fearing.
But supporters of legalizing cannabis appear to have won the debate that it is better to regulate the trade and help Malawi's economy to grow. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Dunia De by Isaka Number One.
Isaka Number One. Big kuna leta kun. An mashakil da dunia. Mashakil ketira sabi. Lakin matakafu. Bukura bikuni omtaki.
We've been listening to Isaka Number One with the song Dunia De. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Bad Marat Nina Binesitu Kali Rabuna.
get free.